And I hope that one day, so, Rick, I'm still on the daily count, because these are the hours of the day in which I can function under both systems. Thursday afternoon, I'm already on. Yeah, I had to suggest that we talk a little bit about Hanukkah. In particular, there are really two things I want to do. One is some of the lessons that Hanukkah has for us today in the 20th century. But the second thing, which is a little less common, is to examine how those lessons emerge, not merely from a general description of the Hanukkah story, but by looking at some of the very detailed halachot, that actually through a passage in the Talmud, which deals with supposedly a very technical matter, which you might think is only of interest to the halachic scholar or the rabbi. In fact, we see some very meaningful lessons as to what Hanukkah can mean on a contemporary level. The basic story of Hanukkah, of course, I'm sure is very well known. This occurred during the occupation of what was called Palestine or Israel, it's Israel, by the Hellenist successors of Alexander the Great, operating out of Syria. And at that point in time, which was during the second Beit HaMikdash, there was a temple, though of course this was in the immediate post-biblical period, there were a number of gezeirot, there were a number of religious persecutions that were going on. In particular, we are told by rabbinic tradition and in the Book of the Maccabees that there were three mitzvot that the Jews were disabled from performing. There was a Shabbat, the observance of Shabbat, Brit Milah, the observance of circumcision, and ironically, Rosh Chodesh, the sanctification of the new moon, which of course was very essential because that was the whole predicate for the celebration of all the holidays, you know, Passover, Shavuot, etc., all depend on a declaration of Rosh Chodesh, and that was disabled. We are also told that there was an attempt to force people to violate the dietary laws, etc. And as a result, there was a bit of a civil war because many, many Jews were in fact Hellenists. Many, many Jews felt that let's go along with this, we can get civil rights, etc. On one level, the Antiochus and his particular government were not anti-Semitic, they were just anti-religious, as it were. They were perfectly willing to grant Jews political and civil rights, but in exchange for the melting pot and giving up their distinctness. One has to remember, therefore, that the struggle of the Hashmonaim was not merely a struggle of Jew against Gentile occupier, but it had the nature of somewhat of a civil war. There were many, many Jews who felt that the Hashmonaim were insane zealots who were living in the Dark Ages and were not willing to become more progressive by assimilation. So it's interesting, you know, the typical American spin on Hanukkah is that it's a celebration of religious freedom. And I guess that's the way we deal with it in the culture that we live in. Then, of course, the so-called December dilemma, in terms of how do you give Jewish kids a sense of Jewish identity when we see the Christmas trees and everything else, and the shopping season, which has already begun the day after Thanksgiving. So we kind of emphasize Hanukkah, and of course, as all of you know as teachers, that is a gross distortion. The importance of Hanukkah in the Jewish calendar in merit is comparable to the centrality of Christmas in the Christian calendar. I mean, Hanukkah is not a Torah festival. It certainly doesn't have the same importance, but we try to give it that importance. But if you know the typical spin we put on Hanukkah is the concept of the religious minority not being oppressed and having freedom of religion. However, that's a little bit of a revisionist twist on the story of Hanukkah, because the real heroes of Hanukkah were people who indeed are referred to in the Book of Maccabees as the Kanaim, the zealous ones, who really, if anything, tried to create a society which imposed the requirements of the Torah on a number of people who didn't want to follow them. Now again, that doesn't mean God forbid that's bad. At some level, one might argue that it's good and proper, but it is important to know that the principle that the Hashmonaim were fighting for was not what you would call separation of church and state and freedom of religion, but rather it was for the right to practice the Torah as the national law of the Jewish people. So it was not an ACLU type of thing, but rather it was really for a very specific religious vision, and that is the vision of the Torah. Now, if you recall, this civil war lasted a very long time, and what's very, very confusing is Hanukkah celebrates two separate things which did not happen at the same time. One thing that happened was that at various points in the struggle, the Syrian Greeks had gained control of the Temple Mount, they had desecrated the temple, and when the temple was finally recaptured, similar to what, let's say, what happened in 1967, and the temple was rededicated, they found a little jar of oil, and the oil was only enough to burn for one day, and lo and behold, it burned for 8 days, and that is the miracle of Hanukkah, also called Chag Ha'olim, the holiday of lights, etc. It also celebrates the victory over the Yavanim and the establishment of the Jewish Commonwealth. Now, we tend in our popular accounts to think that those two events happened at the same time. In fact, they were separated by almost 100 years of struggle, meaning the Temple Mount was reclaimed at a very early stage. But that was the middle of a series of wars and skirmishes and battles that lasted for many, many more years after that. The proof of the pudding is basically, if you look in the Book of Maccabees, which is a detailed historical record, you'll see the Hanukkah story is kind of in the beginning of Book 1, and you still have Maccabees 1 and Maccabees 2. So keep in mind that in the course of time, there has tended to be a collapsing of the miracle of the Neirot with the Nitzachon HaMilchama, the victory of in the war, and in fact there are two very, very different events. And it's interesting that the Talmud, which gives the reasons for the celebration of Hanukkah, focuses exclusively on the miracle of the Pach HaShemen, of the little jar of oil. It does not focus at all as a celebratory victory over Greek or Syrian persecution. And there's a number of very, very interesting speculations why there is such a de-emphasis. For example, if you compare the Talmudic account of Hanukkah with the prayer Al HaNisim, which is what we recite on Hanukkah, and Al HaNisim is a very old prayer that already existed in the time of the Mishnah, you see that Al HaNisim almost totally is a praise to God for the victory of the few over the many, of the impure, of the pure over the pure. In other words, it celebrates the victory that God gave the Jewish people over foreign oppression. That is the Al HaNisim prayer. If you look at the Talmudic reasons of the festival, however, it totally de-emphasizes the military efforts and it stresses exclusively the miracle of the oil. There's a very, very marked discrepancy in what Al HaNisim says we are celebrating and what the Talmud says we are celebrating. And it's a lot of speculation. It's also pointed out that Hanukkah is given very short shrift in the Mishnah. The Mishnah is devoted a whole tractate to Purim and a whole tractate to Rosh Hashanah and for Pesach and everything else, barely mentions Hanukkah. It mentions Hanukkah in a very peripheral way. It mentions Hanukkah as a day that you don't give eulogies for the dead. It has a crazy case of a camel that has very long piston flax on its back, and it's walking through a public market, and the flax gets ignited by a fire that's in a storekeeper's store window, and as a result, some building down the street is set on fire, and there's a discussion, who has to pay for the damages, the owner of the fire or the owner of the camel? And the Talmud concludes, it's normally the owner of the store, because he shouldn't have kept his fire so close to the street, but the Mishnah says, if it was a Hanukkah candle, which is supposed to be lit in a public place, the owner is exempt from damages, and the only one that is obligated is the owner of the camel, who should have safeguarded his flax not coming in contact. So, indirectly, that is the only mention in the Mishnah that there's such a thing as lighting Hanukkah candles. How do we know? Because the Mishnah says that the owner of the store is not obligated if his Hanukkah candle sets some long flax on fire. So, it's almost as if the Mishnah cannot deny that Hanukkah exists. Obviously, it's a holiday. You can't just wish it out of existence. But the Mishnah doesn't want to talk a lot about Hanukkah. Hanukkah is extremely de-emphasized, and therefore we say as little about it as you can get away with. And there's really some endless, fascinating historical and halachic speculation why the Mishnah seems to have such an aversion to the celebration of Hanukkah, and why the Talmud, in turn, de-emphasizes the Nes, the miracle of the Nitzachon HaMilchama, and has converted Hanukkah into more of a spiritualized, ethereal holiday in terms of the miracle of the candles, the little bit of oil that was found. One reason that is sometimes suggested, although it's too ad hominem for my taste, is the fact that, as we know, the Malchut Chashmonai, the dynasty, the Hasmonean dynasty that was established and ruled over the land of Israel for almost two centuries, eventually, as George Orwell's Animal Farm, eventually becomes the very ideal that they tried to overthrow. And the truth of the matter is, if, as a religious matter, the Hasmonean Revolution was not just for political independence, but it was an attempt to eradicate Hellenism from Jewish culture in Eretz Israel, as we know, in one of the very sad ironies of history, many of the Hasmonean rulers did in fact become staunch advocates of Hellenist culture. Many of them became totally non-observant and even antagonistic to the Pharisees, to rabbinic culture. And as a result, Rav Yehuda HaNasi, the author of the Mishnah, did not want to glorify their particular victory, because in fact, as far as he saw it, it did not really achieve anything long-lasting other than a few years of political independence. In particular, it is brought out that Nachmanides points out, even as a matter of halakha, there are some grave problems in the Hasmonean dynasty, because they were Kohanim, and we know that Malchut, Jewish monarchy, belongs to the tribe of Yehuda. Rav Yehuda HaNasi, the author of the Mishnah, was in fact a descendant of Malchut Beit David, and consequently he did not want to emphasize the dynasty of Kohanim. Again, it's more of a personal reason. Yet another reason focuses on the fact that the political reality of the Jewish people at a time when they were when the Mishnah was compiled was that Eretz Israel was under Roman occupation at the time. It would hardly do, it would not be politically correct, to announce that every year we celebrate a successful revolt against a foreign occupying power. The Romans would not enjoy that holiday that much. And consequently, in the time of the Mishnah, there seems to be a transformation, as it were, of Hanukkah from a Bastille Day or 4th of July as a declaration of independence to more of the spiritual event. So there are a lot of different reasons that are given for the change in emphasis, but it can't be denied that although it is not clear when Hanukkah was made a holiday, because it was not made a holiday in the immediate aftermath of either the oil or the Mitzachon, but it's very clear that throughout Hanukkah we have these two themes, the miracle of the oil and the Mitzachon HaMilchama, and at various times in our history one theme is emphasized more than the other theme. It's kind of a spiritual, physical dichotomy, although even the Mitzachon HaMilchama certainly has a very spiritual element, as the Rav HaNisim emphasizes. You have given the many in the hands of the few, etc. In fact, this idea that Hanukkah really commemorates several things, the miracle of the oil, the rededication of the temple, and the driving out of foreign occupation and the reestablishment of the Jewish commonwealth, is really the key image that's given to what is probably the world's most famous question. This is a very, very famous question, and I'm sure you've heard it, and there are clearly more than 1,000 answers to this question. I will not give you all of them. That is, people ask the question, if the miracle of Hanukkah, as described in the Talmud, involves finding enough oil for one day, and miraculously the oil burns 8 days, then the miracle is only 7 days, right? They had enough oil for one day. So Hanukkah should not be celebrated for 8 days, Hanukkah should be celebrated for 7 days. Okay? Now that would mean fewer presents, there would be various problems there, the kids wouldn't support it, but again, you know, if they did it for 7 days to begin with, there wouldn't have been that problem. This is the world's most famous question, probably. Definitely a question that is discussed and written about Hanukkah. This is it. This is a question that is raised by the Bet Yosef, of Yosef Kaya, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, and he gives various answers. But a very simple answer is that you are really celebrating two different miracles, although they were separated by almost 100 years. You are celebrating the Mitzachon HaMilchama, and you are celebrating the miracle of the oil. So consequently, day one of Hanukkah is primarily celebrating the nace of the Mitzachon, and then the rest is the miracle of the oil. So you're combining two at once. Again, there are other historical reasons too. If you look in the book of Maccabees, you discover a very interesting idea, which by the way is not picked up in the Talmud except in a very, very oblique and subtle way. And that is, the book of Maccabees makes mention that year, when the Temple Mount was in foreign hands, the Korbanot of Sukkot were not brought that year because they didn't have the Temple Mount on Sukkot. And there is an intimation in the book of Maccabees that the festival of Hanukkah in Kislev was an attempt to make up Sukkot, although in Halakha there's no particular mechanism for making it up, but they wanted to have it to be a surrogate Sukkot. That, of course, would explain the significance of the number 8, because the Sukkot observances in the temple included the 7 days of Sukkot, and then Shmini Atzeret, which is the conclusion, although there's no Sukkah, but it's the conclusion of Sukkot, and consequently, that might be some of the origin as well. Now, the Talmud itself never directly makes the connection between the period of Hanukkah and Sukkot, but that is a connection that emerges from the Maccabees. That might be yet another answer. Okay.
And
from, yeah.
Isn't
that
the way all the
Shammai say? Yes, that's what I'm going to get to. There's an oblique reference to Sukkot in one of Beit Shammai's formulations, which seems to have no bearing at all, but it might be picking up the book of the Maccabees suggested. But he believes it may. Beit Hillel does not pick up that association, so Beit Shammai might have a remnant of that reference to the book of the Maccabees. Okay, so now, with that little bit of an introduction, that we are in fact celebrating a number of separate and disparate themes in Chanukah, which did not occur at the same time chronologically, but were separated by many years, let's now examine a passage in the Talmud. The Talmud says that, you know, there are three ways you can observe the mitzvah of Chanukah. There's the standard way, and then there's grade A, and then there's A plus. You can do it in three ways. It all depends on how you do it. The standard way, which nobody does, everybody is glad kosher here. The standard way is for each family to light one candle every night. That means on night one, if I have a family of 10, we light one candle. Night two, we light one candle. Night three, we light one candle. Meaning, every night, you light a single candle on behalf of all of your family. The basic mitzvah, the basic obligatory mitzvah, is one candle for everybody, every night. Now, level two, if you want to be a mahadrin, if you want to do the mitzvah in a beautiful way, then you light one candle every night for every member of your family. That's still not our familiar way. In other words, if I have 10 people in my home, I or our family light 10 candles night one, 10 candles night two, 10 candles night eight. Now then it goes on and says, if you want to be mahadrin, min ha-mahadrin, if you want to do the best, the Nebra, Borough Park, Flatbush, right? You want to do it, right? Then, there's another way you do it. And on this third level, we have a machloket, an argument between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, where Beit Shammai says, you start with eight, and you go down. That's called Kochet V'Halech. And Beit Hillel, which of course we follow, is Mosif V'Halech. Now, it's fascinating. I guess you didn't know, right? People didn't realize American Jewry, which by and large is pretty meticulous in lighting Hanukkah candles, didn't know that they're not just doing the minimum. They're doing Mahadrin, Min HaMahadrin. That I've never met a Jew that only does the minimum. Who lights just one candle? Everyone knows that. But keep in mind, this is something people don't always realize, that the Machlokas Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel is not referring to the minimum of the mitzvah. The minimum is one candle. It is referring to an enhancement, and not only an enhancement, but what is called an enhancement of an enhancement. Now, there's a very fascinating machlokis in halakha as what is the relationship between the third level of, you know, the second level of enhancement and the middle level, meaning to the following. The middle level, every member of the family lives. Now, let's say you're bypassing the middle level and you want to do the top level. Does the top level mean you everybody lights for the number of days? Or is the top level only one person lights for the number of days? Now that's a machloket between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. The custom among Ashkenazim is that the highest level encompasses the middle level. So what that means is that it's proper for every single member of the family to light a menorah that has the appropriate number of days, which is basically all here. In other words, if you're doing the top, you're also doing the middle. But Sephardim rule differently. Sephardim rule that if you want to do the best way, only one menorah should be lit. And the reason is, because if the concept is you want to clearly designate the days, then it's better not to have too many menorahs, because you walk by and you see 56 candles in the window. Although the menorahs might be separate, you know, it's not as clear. So if you want to achieve optimal clarity of days, that's what's very interesting as an interpretive problem, if the highest level ignores the middle level, or the highest level incorporates the middle level. Ashkenazim have one custom, Sephardim have a different custom. Again, those of us who are Ashkenazim, the custom is every member of the family writes their own menorah, but then there's a machloket about husband and wife. That's a separate machloket if they should write separately or write together. Okay. Now, be as it may, there are really two questions I want to share with you, and I think through the prism of these technical questions, we can see some very interesting lessons. Question number one is, why is Hanukkah the only mitzvah in which there is such an emphasis on not just doing it, but on these different levels of beautifying the mitzvah? There is a general idea of Hidur mitzvah, we understand that. You try to do a mitzvah in a beautiful way. It is in fact derived from a verse in Az Yashir, by the Song of the Sun, Zeh Keliv Anveyu, this is my God and I will glorify him. And there's a rabbinic interpretation that you beautify the way one serves God by doing mitzvot in a beautiful way. Right? One should recognize that that is a divine commandment. And yet, we don't have these multiple levels by tzitzit or tefillin or shofar. You know, we have generally. Here you have not just one level of mahadrin, but mahadrin, mina mahadrin, etc. And moreover, we find that the Jewish people have, which is not always as meticulous in many commandments, has not only embraced the Hanukkah lights, but they have embraced the highest level of observance, universally. And the question is, what is the special connection of Hidur, beautification, with the idea of Hanukkah candles? That's question number one that I want to explore. Question number two I want to explore is, how do we explain the idea of Tim Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, whether you go up or you go down, and what significance does that have? Right, so first we'll talk about Hidur in general, and then we'll try to see about Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. Okay. Now, why is there Hidur in general? There are two answers that commentaries give. One answer is this. The miracle of Hanukkah, at least if it focuses on the oil, is halakhically a superfluous miracle. Why is it a superfluous miracle? Because what happened here? They found oil that was sealed with the seal of the Kohen Gadol, where it had not been contaminated or touched. It was pure oil, and it was sufficient to burn for one day. And God made a miracle, because it would take really 8 days till they had pure oil, etc. So God made a miracle that this one little oil continued to burn. Now, that wasn't the only oil they had. That was the only Shemen Tahor, that was the only pure oil they had. There was plenty of oil that had come into contact with the Yevanim, etc. That was oil, but it was ritually impure. Now, the halakha is like this. The law is that communal offerings and communal korbanot, like the lighting of the menorah, if one cannot find pure oil, one is permitted to use impure oil. This is a halakha called Tuma Hutcha B'Tzibur. Ritual impurity is set aside for the needs of communal offerings. So the question becomes, gee, what's the whole point of this miracle? There was no point to this miracle, because the halakha was, if they didn't have pure oil, they would have used impure oil. The answer is, the miracle was not a necessary miracle, but it was an expression of God's love, that God wanted the Jewish people, as it were, to enter into a pure relationship with him. A relationship that's untainted with jealousy, untainted with hatred. Pure oil is symbolic of the purity of God's love for his people. And therefore, the mitzvah was superfluous. The mitzvah was unnecessary. The mitzvah was frosting on the cake. Now, it's very interesting. So consequently, how do you express your gratitude to God or doing something he didn't have to do, by your doing something you don't have to do? Meaning to say, it is inherent in the miracle that it was not something that we needed. It was an extra expression of God's love. Consequently, Hanukkah, we go beyond the letter of the law, and we embrace the spirit. And that is why it's not good enough for Hanukkah just to get by. The concept of excess, giving presents, etc., all of that. Hanukkah has a lot of excess. Some of it may come from a bad place, as it were, you know, the need to compete. But some of it comes from a good place, because remember, God gave us more than we needed, and God gave us more than we deserved, as it were. And that is why, and I've mentioned this thought many, many times, but I'll say it again because it ties in, that is why one of the operative words, Blacha Nisim Blacha, is placed in the Blacha of Modim. Modim is we give thanks. Chanukah is referred to as Yemei Hoda'ah, days of gratitude. And of course, the Sfat Emet remarks that all Jews are called Yehudim, although historically Yehudim means a member of the tribe of Judah. Why are all Jews called Yehudim? Again, I mean, obviously historically it's because Yehuda was the dominant royal line. But the Sfat Emet offers a homiletical suggestion. He says he read in last week's Parsha that Leah called her fourth child Yehuda, and she said, because now I am grateful to God. Well, she explains, why was she grateful by the fourth child? Because she knew Yaakov would have 12 boys, and she knows Yaakov has 4 wives, so 12 divided by 4 is 3, so she figures the first 3 are coming to her. So she's not grateful for those yet, but when she has number 4, she knows she's beat the average. She has gotten more than she deserves. And when one feels they've gotten more than they deserve, that generates within a person Hoda'ah. And the Sfat Emet says, every Jew is called a Yehudi, because we must go through life that God has given us more than we're entitled to, and we're grateful for it. Well, Chanukah itself is an exemplar of God giving us more than we needed. And consequently, we give back to God by giving God more than the minimum. And that is one reason why Chanukah is based on Kiddur. So essentially, therefore, Kiddur, doing more than the letter of the law, which applies in all areas of life, not just Chanukah, is a way of giving back. Of course, on one level, you know, God doesn't need anything from us in a sense, but the way we express Hakadosh Hatov is going beyond the letter and embracing the spirits. And that is really one lesson. In fact, there's a very beautiful Kabbalistic teaching, very, very fascinating, about the idea that the lights of the Chanukah represent the divine light of God that is shining into the world, that inspires us and elevates us. There's a beautiful Kabbalistic teaching that if you count the number of Chanukah candles that we light in accordance with Beit Hillel's view, we light, not counting the Shamash, which is just as an extra light, we have a total of 36 lights. Like 36. The typical package of Chanukah candles, I think, has around 40 candles. Shamash, right? They're exact, right? So if you break a candle, you have to buy another box. It's exact. But basically, 36 are the halakhic candles. Now, what's 36? Listen to this beautiful thought. Again, it's a Kabbalistic thought. And that is, you know, God made the sun and the moon on the fourth day of creation. So there were 3 days, there were 36 hours of daylight before that point, which did not have a sun. So what gave the light for the first 36 hours of creation? This was the divine light of God, which was not intermediated by the sun. And God then put that light away and replaced it by the sun. But it is said that those 36 hours of light are called the Or HaGanuz, the concealed light of God, and the 36 candles of Chanukah is a re-revelation of that concealed light of God that comes back into the world again. And that's why it is 36 candles. So Or HaKalat HaTov is to give back to God. That is one perspective. Now, let me give you a second answer. Now, the second answer is technical. And, you know, again, hopefully everyone will follow it, but you know, it makes a very important spiritual point. Again, the question we're discussing here is, why on Chanukah is there a concept of doing more than the law? Answer number one, because God did more for us than we needed. We give back to God. The second answer is this. You know, the story goes that they found a jar of oil that was sealed with the signet of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. Now the question becomes, the high priest was not in charge of the oil of the temple. Like, why would there be a jar of oil that was sealed with the seal of the high priest? That was not his job. They had other, you know, they had custodial people who were in charge of inventory. So the answer is, because the Kohen Gadol himself had to bring a meal offering every day. In other words, this was not oil for the menorah. This was all that the Kohen Gadol used in his own personal daily meal offering. Ah,
So now we have a problem. But wait a second here. The halachot regarding the quality of oil that you need for the menorah is different than the quality of oil that you need for the menachot, the meal offerings. The menorah needed to be pure, clear oil. The meal offering oil, which is mixed with flour, could have sediment in it. So how could the kohen gadol of oil, which must have been for the meal offering, be available for the menorah? Answer, it must be that the kohen gadol did hidur mitzvah, meaning to say he could have used grade B oil, but because of hidur mitzvah, he used grade A oil. Meaning to say, had he not done hidur mitzvah, there wouldn't have been any oil for the menorah. So consequently, the whole miracle came because of his hidur mitzvah in the meal offering. Now, what that teaches you is an opposite. If the first perspective teaches us the goodness of God in giving us and showing us his love, even if that was not a necessary thing that we needed, the second aspect of Hanukkah stresses the devotion and commitment of the servants of God in doing his will. It's a celebration of how devoted the Jewish people are to serving Hashem and doing mitzvahs with beauty. So you're really stressing two types of commitments here and two types of relationships. The relationship of God's love for the Jew and the idea of the Jew's love and commitment for God. And I remember hearing a number of years ago from Rav Lau, the chief rabbi of Israel. Rav Lau is an amazing story. Rav Lau was, and we've read it over the years, he was in a concentration camp when he was around 4 years old. And his older brother used to, when their parents were killed, would keep him in a potato sack. I mean, the Nazis would kill a child immediately. And his brother kept him with him for 4 years, like hiding him in a sack and all sorts of amazing things. And Rav Lau said that after going through this experience, he has a different answer to the Beit Yosef's question. The Beit Yosef asks, why is Hanukkah 8 days or it'll be seven? And he said the answer is the following. Maybe the miracle of the first day is not that they found oil. The miracle is they looked for the oil. He says, because when you look, you never know what you find. The miracle for him was the Nazis didn't look. The miracle of Hanukkah was they looked. And that tells you something. In other words, the miracle that you're celebrating is the devotion of the Jewish people to look for ways to serve God. So Hanukkah, therefore, is a celebration of God's love for us, but it's a celebration of our commitment. Now, our commitment manifests itself in a small way with the menorah and finding the oil. The big way was, of course, the armed struggle to be able to stand up for God's Torah. And this notion that one celebrates not just the greatness of God, but the greatness of Am Yisrael is something that permeates many, many of our celebrations. You know, the Talmud is a beautiful passage that God wears tefillin every day. God wears phylacteries. Whatever that means. I mean, obviously we don't know what that means literally. Now, in our tefillin, you open it up, you have parchments, and the parchments proclaim the unity of God, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Okay, so the Talmud asks, which takes these things very literally, well, if God wears tefillin, what is written inside of God's tefillin? Right, you've got to make a perfect analysis. And the Talmud says, well, if in our tefillin, it says, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, God is one, in God's tefillin, Mi Ka'amcha Yisrael, who is like your nation Israel, of the earth, a unique nation in the world. Okay? So God, as it were, celebrates the uniqueness and specialness of the Jewish people. And the truth of the matter is, one has to recognize that the whole metaphor, the idea, Hanukkah has two miracles, the war and the oil. But you see, the oil is a metaphor for the war, because what is the concept? The concept of the oil is the light that penetrates the darkness, the light that dispels the shadows, the courage of lighting that candle. After all, if I would be a Jew then, I might reason, if I only have enough oil for one day and I have nothing for the next day, why bother to light it? What's going to happen the next day? Right? Let's just wait. But what a person says is, I'm going to light my candle. I'm going to try to dispel whatever darkness I can. And then I'll leave it up to God to do the rest. But God only acts if I do what I can do. So Hanukkah, lighting the candle, it's a miracle of the oil, of course, but it's the metaphor too of the human being who looks at a hopeless situation and says, I will do what I can do. I think Helen Keller writes in an autobiography that, you know, she says, I'm only one person, but I am one person. Meaning, I do what I can do. And then what do we see? Hanukkah teaches us, we do what we can do, and then God at some point takes over. But only if we do what we can do. And therefore, that's exactly what the world is about. You see? That little microcosmic miracle that occurred in the beginning of that armed struggle, in the beginning of it, not at the end of it, in effect gave the Jewish people the courage to go on and do what they have to do. That you don't give up. There will be light. We can connect it to the Torah reading too. We're going to read about Yaakov struggling with the angel, with the man, in this week's parsha, through a long night. And at the end of that night, Yaakov is limping and ill, but the dawn will break. You see, again, it's connected to Hanukkah. There's no accident why those parshiyot are normally around Hanukkah time, because the struggle against night is a recurring motif in Jewish history. And this notion that God responds to human initiative is fundamental to our faith. That on one hand, one has to have faith in God, but one also has to recognize that God responds to human initiative. And sometimes that human initiative requires that we jump into the Red Sea up to our necks. And then God splits it. But God doesn't split it till you show that you're willing to jump into your neck, right? And that's part of the idea of Hanukkah too. And therefore, the notion of the oil versus the war are not really two different things. But through the genius of the Jewish community, as it were, we can meld it, because one really teaches us something about the nature of the other. Okay, so these are the explanations of why Hanukkah we go beyond the law. One reason is because God went beyond the law with us, and the other reason is because the Kohen Gadol went beyond the law in trying to do a mitzvah beautifully, and therefore the celebration of our resilience and our courage, etc., in making the initiative, which gives God the ability to make the mitzvah. Again, this is true in medical ethics as well, right? In other words, Christian scientists say, for example, that it's wrong to seek medical intervention because God brings sickness. We say, obviously, we have a mitzvah to seek medical intervention. It's like the story of the guy that was caught in the flash flood. Very devout person, and he didn't want to take the helicopter, and he didn't want to take the rope ladder or the boat. He says, God will take care of me. And of course, as he's drowning in his final moments of consciousness, he has a silent prayer to God. God, why have you abandoned your faithful servant? And God said, I tried to save you five times. I sent you a helicopter, and I sent you a boat. And you say, God will take care of it, right? That's how God does it. Right? God does not split the Red Sea that many times. And even then, as I said, Nachshon ben Aminadab had to jump in first. Even if, like a miracle, God required human initiative and human courage in seizing that particular moment. Ad kibay kach, that the Pasuk even seems to say that God condemns Moshe for davening. God says to Moshe, there's a time for action here. Stop praying already. Go forth. Right? So human initiative is a very, very major idea, and in fact, that is actually implicit, to get a little far afield, in the notion of Tzelem Elokim, one of the components of being made in the image of God. There are many, many components, morality, autonomy, intelligence, etc., but one of the components is initiative and creativity in coming forth and doing what needs to be done. That is part of being God's partner, God's collaborative partner in Tikkun Olam, etc. Okay. Now let me go now to the second question though, which focuses more specifically on the machloket Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. Beit Hillel seems to have an intuitive logic to his position, right? You go up, etc., well all of a sudden there's Beit Shammai, so you go down. So the Talmud gives two reasons. And again, each of these reasons is very fascinating. Reason number one, this is all in Masechet Shabbat. Reason number one is Beit Shammai says, well, you celebrate on Hanukkah the days that are coming rather than the days that are going. You look at the future rather than the past. So consequently, day one, we celebrate 8 days. Day two, we celebrate 7 days, right? You look at the future, how many days are left? Beit Hillel says you look at the past, how many days have transpired. Now the Talmud doesn't offer any particular reason why one is right and the other is right. I interpret it. Well, It's interesting that one can interpret this, again, in somewhat of a Kabbalistic way, and that is, Beit Shammai looks at a miracle in terms of its potentialities, rather than its actualization. The miracle of the oil was that God endowed a little cruse of oil with the power to burn for 8 days. So day one, that oil had 8 days of power in it. Day two, it only had 7 days of power. So he looks at what is called the koach. Koach is the potentiality. Beit Hillel, which diminished as time went on, Beit Hillel looks at the actualization of that potential as it becomes visible and apparent to the human eye. And consequently, day one, we only saw the potential of 1 day. By day eight, we saw the potential of the actualization of 8 days. So Beit Shammai focuses on potential. Beit Hillel focuses on actualization. Now, why is that particularly significant in a more global view? Well, those of you that studied Mishnah or Talmud know that typically Beit Shammai is the stricter view in Halakha, and Beit Hillel is more lenient view. It's been suggested that the basis for Beit Shammai's strictness is Beit Shammai has an ideal vision of what a human being is capable of becoming. And consequently, he imposes a stronger, stricter standard based on the ideal. Beit Hillel focuses on the actual weaknesses and fallibilities as they become actualized, and consequently this leads into more of a midat rachamim, which is interesting. So although the Hanukkah controversy itself is not a matter of leniency versus strictness, you can't directly connect it, but philosophically it's connected, because in both cases Shammai emphasizes the ideal, Hillel emphasizes the actualization of that idea. In fact, I'll give you another example where this comes out. You know, there's a machlokes that Shammai and Beit Hillel, how does one make Kiddush Friday night? Very interesting. Beit Shammai says, first you make the blessing on the Shabbat, and then you make the blessing on the wine, which is not what we do. Beit Hillel says, first the blessing on the wine, then the blessing on the Shabbat. Now again, you would say, well, it's not a question of strict or leniency, it has nothing to do with anything. But they give a mashal to explain Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. And the mashal they give, the one of the Hasidic writers, they say the following. Imagine a person that is going on a major business trip the next day. And he's very excited because he's going to make a lot of money on this trip. But he needs a valet to pack his bags and do everything. But the valet really has no excitement in this trip because, after all, you know, he's not going to get anything out of it. So how does the owner get his valet to be excited so that the valet will participate in what needs to be done? So the owner will get up a half an hour early, start with eggs and coffee and cocoa, and hopefully the very pleasant aromas will wake up the servant and get the servant excited, not because of the trip, but because of the eggs, because of the cocoa, or whatever it might be. Now, consequently, we have the same dilemma when Shabbat comes. The soul is very excited about Shabbat. It is God's special day. The body sometimes is excited about Shabbat, but maybe in a different way. The body would like to sleep late. The body would like to just sit around and read a novel or read the paper. The spiritual element of Shabbat is not always as exciting to the body, which might be worn out of the demands of the work week. So the question is, how does the soul get the body excited? The answer is, the soul gets the body excited by chowing, meaning to say that the same idea that you get the servant excited by the coffee and by the eggs, so too, Shabbat has made room for physical pleasures and enjoyments as a means of enlisting the body to enable the soul to experience the spirituality of Shabbat. Now, let's go back to Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. So now we also see this notion of ideal versus practical is at the basis of this machlokes, because we drink wine on Shabbat. Now ideally, the way Shammai envisions Shabbat is, I should be so spiritually turned on by the holiness of Shabbat that I want to celebrate by a toast. So if you go with that sequence, you make the bracha over Shabbat. And then, because you're so taken with the holiness of the day, you want to toast the Shabbat. In other words, the wine is an outgrowth of the spiritual feeling of Shabbat. That's the idealist view. Beit Hillel is more pragmatic, however. Beit Hillel says, you know, It's not always the Shabbat that gets us high. Sometimes we need the wine to get us high. Therefore, Beitilel says, first you drink the wine, or make the bracha over the wine, and now you're ready to feel Shabbat. In other words, the question is the physical the outgrowth of the spiritual? Or do we need the physical to enable us to feel the spiritual? So once again, Beit Shammai stresses potentialities. Beit Hillel stresses the imperfect actualization of those potentialities. And that is the basis of the first explanation, why Hanukkah, Beit Shammai looks at potential. Beit, which, and the potential diminishes as time goes on, Beit Hillel looks at the actualization. Yes.
How come we don't follow then Beit Shammai? If he's more idealistic about the human being to become,
it's very interesting that the Ari writes, the great Kabbalist, Yitzhak Luria writes, that when Mashiach... stresses the imperfect actualization of those potentialities. And that is the basis of the first explanation, why Hanukkah, Beit Shammai looks at potential. Beit, which, and the potential diminishes as time goes on, Beit Shammai looks at the actualization.
Yes. How come you don't follow then Beit Shammai? It seems more idealistic about the human being to become.
Well, it's very interesting that the Ari writes, the great Kabbalist, Yitzhak Luria writes, that when Mashiach comes, the law will be changed to follow the view of Beit Shammai. He says that we live in an imperfect world, and Beit Hillel is more responsive to the imperfections of human nature. That the ideal of Beit Shammai is the more perfect ideal that is reserved for the world to come and unite to Mashiach. So there is a concept of halakha going to be changed. That Beit Hillel, I don't know if you would have put on it, but I gave you two examples of Beit Hillel having nothing to do with being strict per se. One is the secrets of the Hanukkah candles, and the other is the secrets of the Kiddush, and yet it is related to the overall idea of potential versus idea. And therefore, in a very real way, Beit Shammai is future-oriented. Beit Hillel looks at the present. Now, that's reason number one for the Gemara, why one goes up and one goes down. Now, reason number two with even more enigmatic. Reason number two is, Beit Shammai says, we go down because the korbanot that were brought on Sukkot went in descending order. Adding up to 70. If you have one Sukkot, the first day we brought 13, bills, second day 12, etc. Now, what is the connection? Once again, this might be a possible basis for Beit Shammai in the teaching of the Sefer of Maccabees, because the Chanukah is enacted as a reported of Sukkot, and consequently, it follows the same pattern. But Beit Hillel says we go up because we go up with holiness, we don't want to go down. Actually, it's very interesting, just to give you an example of, we pass them, of course, like Beit Hillel. Let me ask you this question. What would you say if, for example, you're very poor, and on the fifth night of Hanukkah, you only have four candles, and you have no way of getting the fifth candle? Forget about the Shamus here for a second. So the question is, if it's the fifth night and you only have four candles, do you light four or do you light one? Now some say, well listen, you either light the right number of days, or if you don't light the right number of days, you go back to the basic halakha, which says one. But some say you do as much as you can do. So really, it depends. If the idea is that the first reason, that Beit Hillel says you have to emphasize the correct number of days, that would indicate if you don't have five, you go back to one. That is, you either do the basic or you do the right days. If the idea is to go up in holiness, however, then at the very least, if you lit four the night before, then at least you shouldn't go down to three, and then you light four that night. So, in fact, in Machlokes and Halakha, it's a real case today, because we have very few people who can't get, you know, some other candle, but there is a Machlokes what you do. But, how do we understand this second idea, that Beit Shammai compares Hanukkah to Sukkot, where the cows go down, and Beit Hillel says, we always go up with holiness. So here, we have a very, very interesting interpretation, again by the Sfata Mat that I quoted before, which views this Machlokes, this second reason, this is the second reason in the Gemara, that the first reason is Beit Shammai looks at future days, Beit Hillel looks at past days. That's the first reason, and that's what is actualization versus potential. The second reason is Beit Shammai looks at Sukkot, and Beit Hillel says you go up in holiness. So now we're focusing on the second reason. The Sfata Mat says that we find in our tradition, based on a verse in Proverbs, that a human soul is compared to a candle. A candle. A living soul is a candle. That's why we light a roadside candle. Nor Hashem Nishmat Adam. The Neshama of a human being is a candle of that. Why is this? Because we are vessel. We have the oil, we have etc. We're waiting to be ignited by God's divine light. In fact, even the word for soul, one of which is nefesh, men perishim, is an abbreviation. Men can stand for near. Now, near means a candle, but in the biblical Hebrew, near is a receptacle for oil. So men is really a receptacle. Pei is p'tila, a wick. Shin is shemen, oil. We are a receptacle with the oil, with the wick. We just need to be excited and elevated and alert by God's light, the passion within. And then we burst forth with enthusiasm and joy to do God's will. So when you look at the Hanukkah candles, you're looking at the light not only of God, but you're also looking at the light of the living soul that has been ignited by God. In other words, a Hanukkah candle is a mirror. We look into it, we see ourselves, we see our children, we see the future of the Jewish people in those lights. So again, on one level it's the 36 hours of divine light, but it's also the light of the human soul. Now, then you perfect the human soul, whether it's your soul or someone else's soul. Right? There are two ways you could do this. One is focusing on evils and faults and failures and eradicating them systematically, one by one by one. Beit Shammai says, and again this is consistent with his more idealistic view, that the way one perfects the human soul is by burning away the impurities. As Beit Shammai uses fire as the metaphor for that which destroys. And therefore Beit Shammai says, that's the comparison to Sukkot. What are the 70 cows of Sukkot? They are Keneged, they correspond to the 70 nations of the world that tried to destroy the Jew. Right? 70. And that is why it diminishes, because our hope and our prayer is, as the world gets closer to perfection, the powers of evil get diminished. Similarly, Beit Shammai says, if the fires of Hanukkah are the lights of the soul, then one perfects one's soul by burning away the flaws and the impurities. Therefore, Beit Shammai's logical trajectory is that first day you start up with 8 problems, you burn them away, 7, 6, 5, 4, because if the imagery of fire is that which burns away and refines, then just like Sukkot, there is progressive diminishment as time goes on. Hanukkah will result in that same process. And therefore, Beit Shammai says, if fire is the metaphor for that which burns away the bad, burns away the dross, the impurity, that process should diminish. Beit Hillel, however, says, that's an idealist way of doing tshuva, which is not going to work for most people. And the reason that so is, if one is overly concentrated on their faults, and on their flaws, and on their failures, we often get into a state of despair, depression, and paralysis, where we're so enmeshed in a sense of the lost opportunities that we don't even have the strength to begin anew. And therefore, if Beit Shammai uses the candle as a metaphor for the heat which burns away, Beit Hillel prefers to use the candle as a metaphor for the light of goodness. Meaning to say, you don't get rid of darkness by attacking the darkness with a stick. You get rid of darkness by turning on the lights of goodness. And therefore, if Beit Shammai's motto is, attack the evil frontally and watch it disappear, Beit Hillel says, let's attack the darkness indirectly by turning on the lights. Therefore, you start with one, you go up to two, and increases with three. Now, this is a very, very important lesson. It's a lesson about tshuva generally. And that is, you do tshuva from your strengths and not from your weaknesses. Because every human being has many aspects of life in which they are successful, in which they are confident and competent and basically good. And there's sometimes, it's very, very hard to change, let's say, the bad habits that we have. But if one builds up their goodness inside, as it were, it will have an effect indirectly of getting rid of some of that negativity as well. But you do tshuva from the strength and not from the weakness. Now, once again, this is the idealist versus the pragmatist. The idealist might say, you got a problem, deal with it. Right? Speaking too much Lashon Hara, then just stop speaking Lashon Hara. And if you're strong enough, you can look the demon into the eye and get rid of it. That's the idealist. But Beit Hillel says, we need to do something that way. And essentially, we tell you in the beginning, emphasize those things that you're already good at. Do more of them. Strengthen yourself spiritually. Generate light and love. And by generating the light, the evil will get weakened of its own accord. You see? Sometimes you deal with problems indirectly. You know, just like if you have a difficult problem, sometimes, you know, our brains do some of the thinking while we're asleep. You think about something else. Which is another recommendation for creative thinking. Sometimes the most creative thing you can do is not to think about it. Work on something like your crossword puzzle, watch a movie, take a bath, and in the middle, the mind works. Now the same thing, Beit Hillel is saying, sometimes to get involved in the negativity is not going to take your life. Get involved in something else good. And the air will be dachel dachoshech. They drive it back. So, in short, just to summarize the structure, because we've talked about a lot of things going far afield, we started off with two basic questions, two concepts that emerged from the Gemara. Number one, why is there such an emphasis in the Hanukkah story on going beyond the basic? We have two levels of going beyond. And the two answers that we gave, number one, stressed the fact that this is our gratitude to God that gave us more than we needed. Because remember, they didn't need pure air, they could have needed pure air. And therefore, this is the emphasis of expressing gratitude to God for the over and above that He gives us in our lives. So it stresses God. Lesson number two was that the miracle came only because of the initiative of the Kohen Gadol, who is using better air than we have to use, to which we will happen, and that stresses their very celebration, not of God's kindness exclusively, but the inner commitment of the Jew and the imperative of union in the Jew. Okay, so that's the two answers for the first question. Now, the second part was focusing on a discussion of the dynamics of the machloket, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, whether you go up or you go down. And remember, the Talmud gave two reasons. Reason number one is, Shammai looks at future, Hillel looks at past. And we developed that idea that Beit Shammai looks at potentiality, Beit Hillel looks at imperfect realization, and that has implications for the Shabbat order and the like. And reason number two that the Talmud gives is, Beit Shammai compares Hanukkah to Sukkot, which went down, Beit Hillel says we go up, and this we explain in terms of Beit Shammai looks at fire as that which eradicates the body. And you burn away the impurities, Beit Hillel says that is not a productive shiva for most people because they get too enmeshed in their problem, and then the Beit Hillel says you generate the light. Right? So essentially, these are all general lessons that are not just chemical lessons. These are lessons that apply to how one lives one's life. And again, the most powerful message of Hanukkah is what I said in the beginning. The idea that a human being tries to light one light. Even if it looks hopeless. Even if it says, what's the point? Why should I do something today if it's not going to be around tomorrow? After all, the deal about miracles is you never know that they're going to happen ahead of time. If you know they're going to happen ahead of time, like let me say, when the famous Midrash about Abraham was thrown into the fiery furnace, Nimrod challenges Abraham, you believe in God, and Abraham says, sure! And Abraham gets thrown into the furnace, and Abraham gets saved. Now Abraham had a brother, Haran. Haran was Lot and Sarah's father. And Haran was asked the same question, and Haran said, well, I'll try to wait and see what happens to my brother Abraham. If Abraham gets saved, well, then I'll go with God. If Abraham gets burned, then I have to pick another team. So Abraham gets saved, and Haran, full of confidence, says, sure, I believe in God. He gets burned from the furnace, of course, he gets burned. Meaning, the miracle only works when you don't know that there's going to be a miracle. And you have that faith, and you have that trust. If you're banking on it, then it doesn't work anymore. So the thing about Hanukkah is that the only initiative of lighting light, even when it's hopeless, is that faith which God blesses and makes successful. And that's such a metaphor for everything, because darkness is not just physical darkness. Darkness is persecution. Darkness is ignorance. Darkness is apathy. Darkness is despair and depression. And light is what we do to try to make that situation better, to bring holiness and nobility and goodness in the world. And sometimes the darkness is so great and so pervasive that you wonder, what can a single candle win? And what's the use of lighting that candle? And the lesson of Hanukkah is, you light that single candle, even if it looks hopeless, even if it looks useless, even if it looks worthless. Because if we do what we can do, the God of something is going to take over. But if we just drain the power and don't do what we can do, then God has no basis upon which to perform a miracle. And of course, as Jewish educators, we as well are charged with the idea of trying to light that candle. A very, very, very thick darkness.
Sometimes indeed, it looks as if what's the point of doing something today, if tomorrow they're going to leave the school or whatever it's going to be. And yet Hanukkah above all teaches us we still have to try to light that candle. And then at some point God is going to help us do what needs to be done. So, wish you all a happy Hanukkah and say, David, see you again.
The Book of Maccabees, as you know, is part of a much larger collection of books called the Apocrypha in Latin. It's called Svarim, the excluded writings. We have the Apocrypha in the library here, and you can look at it. Basically, it's very interesting what books made the biblical canon and what books didn't. And these are not even controversial. In fact, some of those that made it almost got excluded. Kohelet, Ecclesiastes. There's a very robust Talmudic debate. There are many people who say, let's keep it out of the Bible, because there's too much stuff like each week of the Mary, they would think that it's not expressive of proper religious attitudes. The Book of Esther, there was some discussion because God's name is not mentioned, etc. So the issue of what goes in and what goes out is very, very controversial. One idea that is very simple, there is no book in the Bible that is as late as the Book of Maccabees, meaning the biblical canon, just as a matter of history, was closed before that point. The Maccabean period is towards the end of the Second Temple, the last 100 years or so, and the Book of Ezra and Kenya, which is the latest, the Book of Esther, deal with at the very beginning of the Second Temple period. But just because they are excluded, it does not mean that they're not valued and studied as a source of history. They are not considered to be divinely inspired, but they are considered to be a primary source. Now, there's another book you may have come across. It's a very small book. It's called Megillat Antiochus, or Megillat Hanukkah. And this deals with the Hanukkah story, but that is from the Middle Ages. That is not... in many synagogues, there was a practice. One of the nights of Hanukkah to read a Megillah, similar by analogy to Megillah, Purim, the very common custom today. But you may find that some people will have it, but that should not be confused with the Book of Maccabees. Yeah.
You said that
there was
about 100 years after the initial.
Well, they continued. Struggles continued into
Rome. The ending of that 100 years, was that being the success of the Rome custom?
No, not at all. Keep in mind that the Second Temple was destroyed in the year 70. Now, all of the events against the Greek persecutions occurred well before the destruction of the Second Temple. Now, the Bar Kokhba Revolution occurred almost 100 years, more than 100 years, after the destruction of the Second Temple, huh?
Not a success,
that's right. The Bar Kokhba Revolution was... hundreds of thousands of people were massacred. Rabbi Akiva, for example, died in the Bar Kokhba persecution. So this was before the destruction of the Second Temple, as opposed to the Bar Kokhba, which is over 100 years afterwards. Any other questions? Cool, I've got to get you all right. I'm looking forward to coming back and talking to you again.
the Karaites in the international tradition of the Jews and both, and the Karaites don't wear tefillin. They believe that the way that they're also a vessel means that if you have something in your mind and in your heart, they don't put on tefillin. How do we know that they're also a vessel? The purpose of the photo in that question means tefillin.
Yes,
but that is, in a certain sense, they give the Chachamim that authority when they're acting, I don't want to use the word deviously, but when they're acting and saying, we're reading this into the text, it's more bold than saying, we know it's not in the text, but we're enacting it. Which one is the bold of authority? I don't know. The case can be made. The case surely is that interpretation is easier to do, but interpretation can be bolder. Sometimes you look at his rush up and say, oh my God, is that what the words mean? Now, usually with interpretation, they're not trying to tell you what the words mean. They're saying, you have the authority to enact this, and this is what we've done. So the case goes both ways. Yeah? That was the next, supposed to be the next lecture, and then swap over into the third lecture. Incidentally, the list of lectures are just a guide as to where we're going. I have a feeling I'm going to throw behind the subject matters in that series, and we'll probably take more lectures to cover the material that's there. But, we're starting off with legislation. The next subject is particular about those, and then how do you change legislation? Because when the Rambam's position is a remarkable position, drushas can be changed in one generation from that which was in another generation. And for example, let me give you a drusha, and then I'll ask you whether that drusha might not be the product of a change in law. The Torah says that when you do chalitza, when a man is married to a woman who has no children, and he dies, and there is a brother, the brother is supposed to marry the widow through yibum. Clearly in the Torah, yibum is the preferred means of satisfying the mitzvah. The widow cannot remarry until either yibum is performed, or the brother regretfully refuses to marry the widow. He performs the act of chalitza. Chalitza is the woman takes off his shoe, and the Torah says she should spit in his face. Well up the former. Chazal say that the former does not kneel in his face, but on the ground in front of the man. Did that drasha, the drasha part, come originally, and that drasha comes simultaneously with the change enacted by Chazal that chalitza is preferable to yibum? We don't know. Could it have been at the time when yibum was preferable and chalitza was a drastically act? She should have spit in his face. But once you say, you can't do chalitza, even if you want to. Exactly, yibum, if you want to. You must do chalitza. You're going to let her spit in his face? The argument of drasha is not clear. We know some drashas in times of war as to what was permitted and what was not permitted on Shabbat. There are records of one bezdin being doresh one way and another bezdin being doresh another way. We have the theoretical position of the Rambam. But very few people ever stop to ask, with respect to individual drushas, did they change over time? Clearly the authority to change over time is there. It's not a process that I'm suggesting. The Rambam says it's perfectly permissible for one generation to say it means literally to spit in the face, and the next generation to learn a drusha that it means to spit on the floor. I would immediately say that is a permissible use of the Midos. Disagrees with the sock of a bacon is also part of Nisa. So you have for laws of the Torah itself, somebody who disagrees with them on a theoretical basis and says this is the way you should behave, even after the bacon is pasken, he also can be part of Nisa. And all that this is to give the rabbinic legislation almost as much power. It says here that just like a Zakeh Mamra can be put to death if he disagrees with the Bezer Rabbanu Yerushalayim as to what is there. Similarly, if somebody gets up and says, I know that the rabbis have added to the Torah my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, my paternal grandmother, I'm not allowed to marry them, but I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway because it's rabbinic. That type of person is attacking the system, right? He's trying to bring down the fire. Look, I'm not accusing Yaakov of doing that, but it's very positive. But maybe it will ultimately bring down the system. And that's why you have statements like that, it's higher than me. But it's meant literally, I'm sure there's a person who says, this is meant literally. That was a true saying. It's a true saying. It's a true saying. It's a true saying.
And not only that, I believe it was in the context of where Mari was originally in the ship, and now it's a hobo. Okay, anybody have any questions? Thank you very much.
Can you just remind me that again the next lecture will be Monday, November 30th, and the lecture following that is December 21st, will be announced.
Thank you.